Get ready for an all-new Hardline segment. It's time to step into the snake pit. And now, with something completely over the top, the host and star of the Snake Pit, Snake.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, I don't often recommend humans watch something, but I really, really, really want everyone to watch this because it is such a fantastic piece of pop culture history. It is such a fun watch. It is a two-hour ride that is called Saturday Night Live, 50 years of music. We're celebrating the 50-year anniversary of Saturday Night Live, putting out all sorts of, you know, 50-year anniversary stuff. This is a two-hour documentary on 50 years of music. And before you say, all those bands suck, it's not about the bands, okay? They don't go through and say, here were the Rolling Stones, and here were U2, and here were the B-52s. They don't, it's not like that.
They're not counting down, like, the best performances in the history of SNL.
This is such a slick documentary. It, of course, it does mention bands that were playing, on SNL, but really, at least 50-60% of this is the music behind the bits, the sketches. So, you know, examples are like Ebony and Ivory that Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo did. How did that start? Whose idea was that? And so they dig behind, and they have on everyone. You know, Eddie Murphy is a huge part of this documentary. I don't remember Eddie Murphy talking about Saturday Night Live ever, much less sitting down in front of a camera and talking about all the things that he did, that he was a part of, within the context of the musical parts of SNL.
Yeah, you talked about James Brown Hot Tub.
Matter of fact, we can start right there.
Okay.
Because you haven't heard any of these stories before. This is the coolest part about it. You just see the finished product of these iconic bits. And then for whatever reason, no one's ever thought to ask these just gods of comedy how these things started. And so that's the beauty of this. And here is Eddie Murphy explaining how James Brown singing and getting into a hot tub came to pass.
I didn't want to do it, first of all, because back then I didn't smoke, I didn't get high. And at the SNL, a lot of people were smoking, and it was 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and Barry Blaustein and David Sheffield, who wrote Coming to America, they was like, hey, you know what would be funny? If you was James Brown in the hot tub. And I was like, what? And I was like, get the f*** out of here. Y'all be smoking that talking that crap. I ain't doing no crazy hot tub. I'm full of water. I say hot tub. And then when we did it, it was, it's the funniest thing ever.
Check in the hot tub. Yeah. Willie made me sweat.
That's just so crazy over the top.
He sticks his toe in.
It's too hot. Too hot for the hot tub.
Too hot. Hot tub.
It was so great when Donovan did that a handful of ticket stocks ago. But that's kind of what this thing is all about. And it is just genius. Matter of fact, like the first 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, I don't even know. And Dave, you've seen it. They'll put like a band up there, you know, that appeared in 1978, Blondie or somebody like that. And then next to it, they'll put up Fine Young Cannibals. And then next to that, they'll put up the B-52s or whatever. But all the songs sound alike. They're all in the same key, and they're all playing at one time. And it's the coolest thing.
Yeah, it's like a 10-minute mashup.
Ugh.
I sent you the screen grab of when they mashed up Cher and Hanson.
Yes.
And my little crush, the middle boy,
right,
was on the screen.
Well, you didn't know he was a boy at the time, and you know, it's a different story. But yeah, and not only that, I mean, they've got, you know, Adam Sandler is interviewed about how he kind of got his start, and he never thought that this would be the case. But and Jimmy Fallon as well. They're like, without this, without us being able to do music, we aren't who we are.
Yeah,
I mean,
Same with the Lonely Island guys.
Yeah, we'll get to the Lonely Island guys because their story is, and Andy Samberg is absolutely amazing. One of the first, matter of fact, the first musical bit that was pitched was the Blues Brothers, which became, look, I don't know where they rank all time in Saturday Night Live lore. They're way, way up there, though. And, you know, it spun off and it was one of the first movies, one of the first spinoff. Matter of fact, it may have been the first SNL movie that Lorne Michaels produced and, you know, making $100 million or whatever and becoming this iconic movie. Well, this was an idea because, John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd both love the blues. And John Belushi, as many people were saying, and Jack White's a big part of this too, he was like, he can sing, like flat out sing. And it's annoying when you see these comedians be able to get up there and just sing.
Yeah, like do his Joe Cocker impersonation.
Oh my God. It is so absolutely perfect. And so they tried to sell Lorne Michaels on the concept of the Blues Brothers. And Lorne Michaels is like, y'all are nuts. Not a chance we're doing this. So
that was an interesting part in this entire documentary is how many ideas Lorne Michaels shot down.
Right.
That somehow ended up on the show and becoming hugely successful.
Right, where he's just like, no way. And so here's how the Blues Brothers started.
So during the week off, they come up with this concept of these two brothers who play blues. And they wear sunglasses day and night. So I wrote an arrangement of a song called Hey Bartender. We rehearsed the Saturday Night Live band. Did it for Lorne Michaels. Didn't make the show. Lorne said, frankly, I don't see anything funny about the Blues Brothers. So they gave up. They said, if Lorne doesn't like it, we're wasting our time. Wednesday, about 3:15, Lorne comes out of read-through and he says, the show's 3 minutes short. John and Danny jumped on him and, Lorne, the Blues Brothers. So Lorne said, we have nothing worthwhile to put in those 3 minutes. You guys might as well make fools of yourselves.
Full costume, everything.
It's shocking sometimes when you see things like, you know, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi making music and it also happens to be good music. It almost makes you upset if a comedian can just turn it on like that.
So it killed. And that became, you know, along with about five or six other things, a staple of Saturday Night Live in the early years.
It was interesting, too, that they would do the bees.
Yeah.
They kind of did a blues sketch where there were like four or five of them dressed as bumblebees.
Right. The bees were a big time sketch back then.
Yeah. But Belushi hated it because he thought the costumes were dumb. And so that's why he and Aykroyd came up with the Blues Brothers because they wanted to do this musical bit, but they wanted to look cool.
Yes. Yeah. It's absolutely brilliant. And Belushi was just a sonic force of energy and comedy that guy was. I mean, he's all over this thing. On the front of actual bands that showed up there, I don't know where Nirvana ranks, but I didn't know the story behind Nirvana and why they ended up doing it when they did. And then Dave Grohl's a huge part of this too. He's just like, you know, talking about how freaked out everybody was at the time. But Charles Barkley was the host back in 91.
That's right.
So Barkley's a host with Nirvana, and they have all of this behind the scenes footage, like B-roll footage for 50 years worth of sketches and musical guests.
And from dress rehearsal footage.
They kept everything.
Wow.
And they show you all this stuff. And part of it was when they shoot these promos, which we see all the time of like, hey, I'm Christopher Walken and musical guest of the Foo Fighters, you know, and they do like three or four of them, whatever. Well, Barkley's out there with Nirvana doing this bit, and Dave Grohl, who's, you know, just a pie-eyed kid at the time, he's got this look on his face looking around like, I cannot believe I'm here.
Like he's never been in a TV studio before in his life.
No, and you'll hear him within this bit talk about a camera, like going, Jesus, look at these cameras. I mean, it's Dave Grohl, but it's so cool.
David Geffen called me about Nirvana because they were on his label, and he said, I don't know what's happening, but you know, last week they sold 60,000 records, and this week they sold 140,000, so something is happening.
You felt it. You felt that
Nirvana was there and people were talking about it, getting more calls than you ever got before from friends in my hometown. Just like, what's he like? What's Kurt like?
Nirvana on SNL was the first time I'd seen them perform live. I didn't have cable in my house in high school, so that was very exciting. That whole week we had talked about Nirvana's going to be on SNL, Nirvana's going to be on SNL. Me and my friends had been learning their songs in our bedroom, too.
Jesus Christ, look at that camera.
To me, it was the most iconic American television show of all time.
Hi, I'm Charles Barkley, host of the season premiere of Saturday Night Live with Nirvana. Look, Mom, your favorite, Nirvana.
The first time we came to Saturday Night Live, I was absolutely f***ing terrified. So we get up and you kind of check to make sure everything works. Guitars, drums, speakers are up, mic is up. And then you try to be really quiet. And then they start to count you down. The room gets dead silent. Your heart is racing and you're thinking, oh my God, I'm going to faint. I'm going to puke on live television. I'm going to die. And typically what happens if I get nervous, I beat the shit out of the drums twice as hard.
Ladies and gentlemen, Nirvana.
I was hitting the drums 10 times harder than I've ever hit them before in my life. By the first verse, I had snapped my snare stick in half, which is not good. And I thought, oh, and this is only like 20 seconds into the song. And there was one break right before the first drum roll, I think, where I grabbed another stick really quick and busted into it. I mean, it was so close to being like Titanic level disaster.
And all those dudes that
this
were...
it's going to be about Dave Grohl.
...that were young at the time, Sandler and all those guys and Chris Rock, you know, they're all talk about like standing on the side of the stage watching like what they feel like is this incredibly iconic moment. Like, holy crap. Jimmy Fallon was, he was like, how do three guys make all that noise? You know, like it's real. I mean, there's a lot of chill, like goosebumpy type moments that you forget about that happened on that show. The first time they talked about this, the very first time hip hop was ever played on live TV was Saturday Night Live.
Huh.
And it was in 1981 and no one even knew what rap was or hip hop or anything. But Blondie, who was from Queens, knew these folks that were basically just street rappers. That's it. And she was the host of SNL. And she convinced Lorne Michaels to get these people that were street rappers to perform musically. And it is the very first time. I'd never even heard of them. What were they called? The four?
Four plus one?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Fantastic Four or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, it's all right there. And you're like, holy crap, that's the first time anybody has ever seen anything like that before. Ever. It's so cool and really moving too as they go through, you know, the amount of hip hop artists that did appear after that. But the very first time America ever even heard rap outside of people that knew about it in New York,
right?
That was it right there. All right, let's carry it over because there's a lot more, including the Lonely Island guys, Andy Samberg, D in a Box. How did all of that start? We'll do it in 3 minutes.
Off. Without telling him, and he was so pissed, and there's audio of him saying, don't they understand I'm 50% more influential than any other human on the earth?
50% more influential than anyone else on the earth.
That's hard to quantify.
I know, but he was just insane. It's so good. It's such a great walk down memory lane. It's such a glimpse into pop culture over 50 years. Dude, it's well worth your 2-hour time.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
You said there's
other documentaries too about the 50s?
Yeah, I think
there's like a 4-part docuseries. You know, they talk about the writers, they talk about the audition process.
Wow.
They talk about the cowbell sketch. Like, there's a whole episode on the cowbell sketch.
No way.
Yeah.
So it's all coming out, but this is really, really good.
All right.
And then they have their primetime special coming up at the end of February, I believe.
Yes, they
do. It's on Sunday night, like the 23rd or something.
Yeah. And the Lonely Island guys, Andy Samberg and his band of idiots that...
The other two.
...were such a big part of Jorma Taccone, or I can't remember that guy's name, but yeah, they're the behind-the-scenes guy in Lonely Island. Samberg is the front man. And the way that they were discovered was Jimmy Fallon was hosting the MTV Music Awards. And he goes into the writer's room before they start, you know, rehearsing and all that. And he's like, who are these guys? And it was three kids, as he described it, Samberg and these other two guys. He's like, they looked like they were from Brooklyn, but they worked their ass off and they were hilarious. So he goes to Lorne Michaels and he goes, I know nothing about these guys, but I saw their work ethic. I saw the content and I'm kind of sold. You'd be a fool not to kick the tires on him. And so Lorne brings them on board and says, just go do your thing. Well, they're not cast members. They don't even know what to do, really. And so they go out with like just a little camcorder, essentially. And Will Forte at the time was a cast member and had this idea to do a bit called Lettuce. And it was about these two guys that were having a very deep conversation about their problems and, you know, close ups on both of them. And then they'd pan out and both of them were holding a head of lettuce. And as they're talking, they would eat the head of lettuce, but they were kept talking real seriously. And it was just nonsensical insanity. And so Lorne loved it and was like, go do something else. Whatever you want, go do it. And so here is them describing their first hit, which is Lazy Sunday, The Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah.
And really one of the first viral YouTube sensations that we ever saw. This is how all that went down.
After that, we knew that it was possible to get something that we just filmed on a mini DV camera on our own on national TV. So we were trying to think of another idea.
We knew Parnell had done his raps on Update, which we had loved.
Listen up, bitch! You know she sends me! When she looks my way, I can't defend me! All I can do is pray for her to spare me from a sweet death ray! But the bitch really wants to take a roll in the hay!
The next thing that we tried was Lazy Sunday, and it was me and Parnell.
Lazy Sunday, wake up in the late afternoon. Call Parnell just to see how he's doing.
Hello,
what up, Pons?
Yo, Samberg, what's cracking?
You thinking what I'm thinking?
Party up,
man, it's happening.
We had no expectations on it, truly. We were like, just hoping it aired.
Jorma made the beat Lazy Sunday. And he just did it on his SNL computer, as far as I know.
I had to make a beat fast. And it was kind of the first time that you could make music fast enough, like using the computers that we had that were strictly meant for like writers to write on.
68 to Broadway.
We never got a shooting permit. We didn't have a crew either. We would just get into a van or something. We kind of liked the lo-fi aesthetic as well because the show was so polished.
2, 6, 12
Break a dozen.
I told you that I'm crazy for these cupcakes, cousin.
Did you watch Home before?
Yeah, we got. It was like being on ecstasy.
Lazy Sunday, that was the first time I had ever been in the vicinity of like a phenomenon. The first YouTube clip I was ever sent was Lazy Sunday. I remember going back home to Oklahoma. I was in an airport and someone had a t-shirt that said, you know, Mr. Pibb plus Red Vines equals Crazy Delicious. I mean, it was like... Overnight, this became a huge thing.
Yes, the chronic, what kills the Narnia?
We love that chronic, what kills the Narnia?
That's that chronic, what kills the Narnia?
So I remember where I was that night when I saw it and instantly calling Danny, who was our producer at the time, and like, holy crap, did you just see that?
Yeah, man.
Neil Young was the musical host at that time, and I think he had either just played or I was waiting on him to come on, and that popped on, and it's still to this day one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Period, end of story. Then they go on, and as Samberg said at the end of this bit, then D in the Box. And Justin Timberlake is part of this documentary, and they go deep into D in the Box and how it was created and how it was an 11th hour, literally Thursday night, the idea came to their heads. They had 48 hours to put it together, and it was a wild-ass S-show trying to get that thing in the can.
Yeah, that's another part of this that you can feel the stress. Because
it's horrific.
Yeah. Because generally, Tuesday is writing day, Wednesday is pitch day, and then they're shooting stuff and rehearsing stuff Thursday, Friday, Saturday. But a lot of these don't come together until Thursday night, Friday, and they're working like 24 hours straight just to get it done and get it on the air.
And you wonder why they're hooked on drugs and stuff at times, because they are busting their ass for months at a time putting these things together. Then they start talking about like the musical guests that are also the host the same week. And, you know, Mick Jagger and Billie Eilish and Bad Bunny. I mean, there's a ton of them that have done it through the years. The stress level on them.
The costume changes just.
Oh, my God. I don't know how they do it. I really don't. So they also talk about the bad music. And whether it's bands that didn't really work out. There were a couple that were so bad in the 70s, no one even clapped when they were done. It's hilarious. Captain Beefheart. Yeah. No one clapped. It'll get silence. He's like, thank you. But one of them was Rage Against the Machine, who they were the musical guests with Steve Forbes.
Yeah, who had been running for president but had just dropped out of the race.
Of Forbes magazine.
Yes, sir.
The billionaire.
Sure.
So they put Rage Against the Machine on there. So Tom Morello from Rage is telling this story about how they were trying to hang flags upside down on their monitors.
American flags.
American flags, yeah. With, by the way, did you see the pentagram?
Yeah.
Like, and the 666 on there?
Yeah.
Like, they were just going balls to the wall, whatever. Upside down American flags with pentagrams. All right? So that was their idea, and then this.
They asked us to please remove the flags from the amplifiers because, one, advertisers would be upset, and two, it was with Steve Forbes, and that might be a weird vibe. We were like, you invited Rage Against the Machine, the f*** you, I won't do what you tell me band, and then said don't do the thing. Just to be clear, that's what you're saying right now. Like, great.
Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Forbes!
So, night of the show comes, and our roadies are primed.
Check 1, 2, 2.
We're about to rock Bulls on Parade, and our roadies put the upside down flags back up onto the amplifiers. The stage manager is barking
pause
into
it here.
His head.
So you can hear as they cut away. Again, this is footage from 1990, whatever, 6 or something. And you hear the stage hands telling them, I wouldn't do that, man.
Right.
Meaning,
take those down.
Take the flags down.
So this is like the commercial break right before they're supposed to come back.
Right before they're going on.
Right.
The stage manager is barking into his headset like, take those down right now. Our roadies have been told to like defend the perimeter. There's 35 seconds until we're live. The stage manager sends the SNL crew. There's a quick scrum on stage. Unfortunately, the burly New York City union men are able to wrestle the flags off of the amplifiers with 7 seconds to go before we go live.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rage Against the Machine.
So then what happened was they finished the song. They finished Bulls on Parade. Well, the guy that they go back to their dressing room and they tell him, we're running tight. We're running a little tight on the show. You don't have to do your second song. Well, that pissed off the bass player. The bass player takes one of the American flags that was stolen off their amps, wads it up into a giant ball, runs across the hallway into Steve Forbes' dressing room, and the way Tom Morello described it, it was like a giant weapon, and hums it into the room. Only problem is Steve Forbes is out on stage getting ready to do a skit, but his kids and family and cousins and aunts and uncles are all in there, And he had just dropped out of the presidency, so he had Secret Service there.
Oh, my gosh.
And the Secret Service come rushing into the Rage Against the Machine room and literally throw them out.
Yeah, they were booted onto the sidewalk outside 30 Rock.
No
yes,
way.
Yes. Oh, it's so great. And then, of course, the most controversial thing to ever happen to Saturday Night Live was the Sinead O'Connor ripping up the photo of the Pope, in which she didn't tell anybody she was doing that in rehearsals. She had a picture of a child in the rehearsals, and then grabbed the picture of the Pope and said, "Fight the real enemy," and then ripped up the picture as everyone is sitting there that works on the show going, "Oh, no."
I think I heard the director say something like, "Oh, she just ripped up the Pope on national TV."
We were standing right where you're right behind you watching. Right there, I looked up, and everyone's, like, mouths have dropped, and everyone's, like, freaking out.
They were blaming Lauren and us, but, you know, we explained that she did it on her own. And she was kind of right.
Sirens were going off in the background in the control room and all that stuff. There was a part of me that just admired the bravery of what she'd done and also the absolute sincerity of it.
She was speaking to her own abuse that she had endured in the Catholic Church and speaking for children and young people who had been molested, you know, through the centuries, and she paid the price for it.
That picture's of him when he did his tour of Ireland. Ireland has the highest instance in Europe of child abuse I experienced of myself, and I found his presence in Ireland telling the young people of Ireland that he loved them hilarious.
Since then you have taken me for
I just remember thinking, like, whoa, she's so strong. Like, I could never be as strong as someone with that type of political view that you would take that kind of a stance. I just remember being sort of mesmerized by her.
And that ruined her.
Yep.
As we said when she died, that absolutely ruined her. And as, what's his name? The guy that, at the beginning of the guy that ended up being the governor of Minnesota. What's his name?
Franken.
Yeah, Al
Franken. Jesse Ventura.
As Al Franken said,
Senator.
She was right.
Yeah.
Like, she was proven to be right in that regard. And, but yeah, that was total chaos. They talk about Kanye ruining the show multiple times. Because of his ridiculous demand list that, I mean, like, him taking over the stage at the close of one of the shows and going on a rant with a MAGA hat on in 2016, which I don't remember. They cut him off, I think, at some point. And he was insane.
Yeah, and the audio, like, there was a set. He was the first performer that they allowed to dress the set where the bands play. You know, that before that, you would always just play against the brick backdrop that mm-hmm. they would have.
Mm-hmm.
But he was allowed to dress the set. But I guess he had some reflective surfaces that you could see, like the cameras and stuff. And so in between dress rehearsal and the show, they took all that stuff off without telling him. And he was so pissed. And there's audio of him saying, "Don't they understand? I'm 50% more influential than any other human on the earth.
50% more influential than anyone else on the earth."
That's hard to quantify.
I know, but he was just insane. It's so good. It's such a great walk down memory lane. It's such a glimpse into pop culture over 50 years. Dude, it's well worth your 2 hour time.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
You said there's other documentaries too about the 50 years?
Yeah, I think
there's like a 4-part docuseries. You know, they talk about the writers, they talk about the audition process.
Wow.
They talk about the cowbell sketch. Like, there's a whole episode on the cowbell sketch.
No way.
Yeah.
So it's all coming out, but this is really, really good.
All right.
And then they have their primetime special coming up at the end of February, I believe.
Yes, they do.
It's on Sunday night, like the 23rd or something.
Yeah.